You're listening to Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz.
Now on the line, we should have the one and only Russell Brown. Are you there, mate?
Kia ora, I am here.
Ah,
kia ora.
How are you? And this evening, we're chatting about the early days of 95BFM. There's a bunch of articles up. From the first 10 years to some of our pirate history.
Yeah, BFM's first 10 years is actually two stories. There's the official story, and then there's the pirate story.
Ah, oh, we love pirates here.
Actually better. The pirate story's amazing. And until I actually wrote that those audio culture articles, a lot of it was still a secret decades later. So that was a nice thing to break, actually. Should we start with the official, what became BFM?
Okay, yes, yeah, Russell, yeah. Talk us through the official history of 95 BFM.
Camping Week 1969, group of students get together and record some programs, and they call it Radio Bosom, and they sail out on the Hauraki Gulf, and it went okay. They managed to broadcast something, but as would happen time and again, post office officials, the post office inspectorate, were onto it straight away. So they actually, they came in fairly soon because they weren't very good sailors and they also got seasick.
Russell, can you just talk us through how the post office would get wind of a broadcast happening and then have officers to go and track down the suspects?
Did they just have people listening to all sorts of frequencies back then? Is that it?
They must have. Broadcasting was incredibly locked down at the time. Mm. There were not only rules about what you could do on the radio, you basically weren't allowed to express an opinion on the radio.
Mm.
And that had been a response to going back to the likes of Uncle Scrim, where it was decided that there was too much potential for radio to inflame the masses.
Mm.
So basically, radio had to be basically about the weather.
Boring.
And you couldn't actually do anything. And the official stations were all owned by the government.
Mm.
There was no private radio, and you basically couldn't do much.
Okay.
And so you had the post office inspectorate, must have been monitoring the spectrum for illicit activities.
Mm-hmm.
So they picked up this broadcast from the boat, and immediately that was cracked down on. And for the next few years from there, they basically broadcast in the quad.
Yes.
It was called a radio station, but it was basically just speakers out in the quad.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, the people involved then went on to do other things. The breakfast host on that first broadcast on the boat was Roger Crumpet Brain, who was actually Roger Fowler, who's a community activist out in South Auckland. He's done heaps of stuff. But the prime instigator was a guy called Dave Neumagen, who later renamed himself Arif Usmani, but maybe known to generations of BFM listeners as Auntie Uncle of the Aunties, who, of course, were a big part of the kids' show on BFM for a long time. So they were a very interesting group of people, and it proceeded along and... there was one particular occasion when Sue Kedgley led a group of feminists into the studio and they did a takeover, and that sounded fun. And the DJ then was a woman called Julie Pendray, who was the first woman on air on the station, and who quite soon, and this was happening really early on, she got headhunted by some of the other stations. You basically won a competition and became a Hauraki DJ,
mm-hmm.
because they'd actually gotten on air by that point. They'd made their case that there should be private stations. So it was Radio I and Radio Hauraki, but there was absolute resistance to doing anything else, and least of all letting these scruffy students do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got a low-powered AM signal that reached as far as the halls of residence, and they're expected to be happy with that. The law after the Kirk Labor government came in was rewritten, and in theory it was possible to get temporary licenses, but no one had ever got one. Roger Douglas, who was the Minister of Broadcasting at the time, wouldn't talk to them. Glenn Smith, who was on the air as Jonathan Schwartz, got a phone call in the studio from a number from Wellington, and it turns out that it was the Minister of Broadcasting. This is just before the government changed. It was Bert Walker. It seemed like they kind of, you know, like the SIS knew. It was quite a bizarre situation. But that didn't work out until the government changed. And then Glenn Smith went along to one of Roger Douglas's campaign events and bailed him up there and got a kind of a commitment out of them. The Broadcasting Tribunal tried to get in the way. They were concerned about the potential for bad language. They put a condition on the license that there had to be a cash bond of $50,000, which was a shitload of money in 1974.
$50,000 in 1974. Oh,
it's so much money. I mean, I don't know, it's $300,000 now, maybe, allowing for inflation. The Students Association happened to have a very forward-thinking president, Clare Ward, who said, yeah, we'll put up the $50,000, which the Broadcasting Tribunal was not expecting.
Mm-hmm.
So they did it, and they managed not to swear and lose, lose their bond. So that was in 1974, Radio Bosom 1XB. Conducted its first legitimate broadcast. It was still not kind of ideal, because they'd gotten through on the basis that it was a student information service. So they were ordered to have no more than 6 to 10 minutes of music per hour, and the rest had to be student-oriented informational talk, which didn't really
boring.
Happen. really boring radio.
Russell, just to go, I just used the Reserve Bank's inflation calculator.
Yeah.
$50,000 in quarter one of 1974 is worth $700,000 in today's money.
Holy shit. I mean, you've got to say, AUSA hasn't always been a supporter of its own radio station, and it kind of wasn't. Yeah, in the early days, it was a bit like, oh, what's this? What's going on here in our name? Yeah. And they were really only involved because it involved their buildings.
Mm. Yes.
But by that point, you had the record companies saying, "Hell, this is really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Here's someone that will play all this new music we've got, particularly reggae."
Yes.
I'm pretty sure that the first radio station in New Zealand to play Bob Marley and reggae in general was BFM.
Wow.
And so you had the record companies coming and bringing them records,
mm-hmm.
which was nice. As noted before, you also had the commercial radio stations poaching. So that was kind of amazing. And so all this stuff was going on, and yet the official resistance was absolutely remarkable. It should also be said it's another victory for the clubs system at university.
Yeah, totally. Mm.
Because a lot of basically this came out of the radio club.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because the people who started the radio station, right from the pirate days, were people who could actually make radios, and they could make transmitters, and they did that. Eventually you got through to, to the late 70s, and BFM was on there a bit more consistently. It was still difficult. It was delivering a lot of people who became quite famous in radio. John Sweetman, the continuity voice of TV3,
yes,
BFM. Larry Somerville, later head of More FM. future Auckland councillor, Glenda Fryer, Pat Courtney, who was actually a big deal on New Zealand Radio on ZB before he headed off to Ireland, where he's actually got a successful radio career there. He was another BFM person. So there was a lot going on. And you've got to have a special word for Glenn Smith as well, who was not only, you know, I'll get onto the pirate broadcast in a moment because that's the other side of the story, and he was part of those. But he went and went to manage 1XX in Whakatane, which has a really special status in New Zealand radio stations. And he got the New Zealand Order of Merit in 2014 because it's still an independent radio station with all that consolidation, you know, all the local identity wiped out by the two big radio chains. 1XX and Whakatane, run by Glenn Smith, ex-BFM, has held the line.
Wow.
And he's still doing it. Yeah. Yeah. He's, no, cool dude. But then we move on to the other side, which is even more fun. basically, while on the surface, the BFM folk were, you know, playing ball and just playing music in the quad, and even, you know, there were objections to that because it was too loud and might, you know, stop people studying or something. But from 1972, using a transmitter they built themselves, there was a station called Radio U, which officially had nothing to do with the respectable students at Radio B, as it was.
So there's two renegade stations. Well, one.
Yeah, two renegade stations run by the same people. One sort of legal and not actually on air, and the other one on 1380 kilohertz. And it was actually quite a ballsy thing to do, because the crack post office team was onto them really quickly. First time, you know, the post office inspectors came, were obliged to leave after they couldn't detect a radio signal. And, you know, everyone at you know, the official radio station said, we don't know. Again, it was the same people. So they tried again. They came three times in 12 hours, couldn't find the transmitter, threatened a visit from the police. Jonathan Swartz, aka Glenn Smith, got the call from the Minister of Broadcasting, Bert Walker, who apparently Glenn told me he congratulated the students on the quality of their program, but warned they were risking their chances of obtaining a temporary license in future. So they shut down, they finished with God Defend New Zealand, and it looked like it. But then there was this battle to get this temporary warrant that supposedly, you know, was available, but the Broadcasting Tribunal was just not about to grant one. You know, it was crazy talk. Everything was locked down. And so they started, I think it was 1973, they started up again. Post office inspectors came back, and that was amazing. They followed a wire down from the roof of the Student Union building and found the transmitter. But as they were preparing to seize it, three Bora bombs were thrown into the tunnel, filling it with smoke. And then a mass of students appeared out of nowhere. Some of them held the inspectors back, and the others grabbed the transmitter, loaded it onto a truck, and drove it away. And a student told the Auckland Star, the inspectors took it all rather well, considering.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was another time when they tried to get it, and the inspectors were locked onto the roof. we found it, and now we can't get off the roof of the buildings. So it actually did come to court. AUSA was actually up in court, and they got off on a technicality, basically. And then they thought, okay, look, the guy that drove the van had been ID'd, and the cops were hassling him and shaking him down to search for weed and that kind of thing all the time. So they thought, okay, will surrender the transmitter, and did so, left it by the Auckland Harbour Bridge with a can of beer and six straws, and they still can't remember why there were six straws.
Yeah, six.
But yeah, in the midst of all this, there'd been these spontaneous kind of flash mobs of students doing things like. Like letting down the tires of the van when it tried to give chase, and it really is amazing. And there's a third part to it, which is after BFM had sort of gotten its AM license, and it could only broadcast for part of the time, but it was sort of on the way, and the new commercial broadcasters, because 89 FM had just started at that point, they were a little bit worried about the competition, because the same group of students said, bugger it, there should be more FM on the dial. Again, really, really resisted by the post office because it might, interfere with taxis or something. Mm-hmm. So they built a mobile transmitter that they broadcast from in various locations around the central city, in a lot of cases actually having quite well-known radio stars coming in and broadcasting anonymously. Mm-hmm. And it actually ended up, it forced the issue of FM, and it really made a difference. It's such a fascinating story because it a lot of this stuff actually had really good consequences.
Yes, yes.
Hmm.
I'm also, I'm just surprised at some of the antics these people got up to as far as like letting down tires and locking people on roofs and that sort
Everyone's
of stuff.
Too
people
well behaved just, now.
Yeah. People are like, well, no, we're going to like make a stand on these issues, which is bloody good,
Yeah, well, they even did a telethon.
Yeah.
Had six phone lines open. Took pledges.
Yeah.
So, it is kind of remarkable that that all this stuff happened, and the fact that it was a secret for so long who the pirates were.
Yes,
and of course they were largely the same people who were supposedly the well-behaved students behind Radio Bosom. So, yeah.
Okay, Russell, what are the names of the articles on this early pirate radio culture that we're talking about?
There's one called BFM: The First 10 Years.
Yes.
And there's another called BFM the Pirates.
BFM
and the Pirates. There's a few photos from that as well.
There's some great photos of news
clippings.
Bless the
people who kept everything, actually.
Yeah.
It's amazing that everyone was able to, A, build the stuff, B, use it and, put up a good fight and manage to get the station as we know it on air.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of part of the counterculture. And from very early on was also part of the live music scene. There was I haven't got the name in front of me at the moment. The guy from the Blues and Jazz Club helped them set up, the first home, because AUSA didn't want to know, for Radio Bosom was actually over in the Arts Centre across the road.
Yes.
And that was, so it always had its place in the ecosystem.
Yep.
And then you got to the end of the 70s and all those people left university. And at that point was when the modern BFM began. And you had people like Andrew Dickens and Drew Darnaroo and Debbie Gibbs started appearing.
Mm.
And that's another story in itself. I mean, Debbie Gibbs did an amazing story. Yeah, amazing job of gaming the system and worked out that you could actually get, because they were still on temporary licenses, you could get temporary warrants and just string them together.
Yes.
And just broadcast forever.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nothing in the law to prevent it because they hadn't thought anyone would do that.
Yes.
So, it's this constant story of enterprise.
Enterprise, innovation,
Wow. Great texts coming on through. Someone said, could have bought two houses for 50G back then.
Yeah.
And then mid-70s, my family bought a house for 17,000.
Oh, my God.
And that so,
but imagine the AUSA having that much money 50, to throw 000, around.
Yeah, it's crazy. Hey, now, Russell, thank you so much for chatting to us this evening.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we hit some Bob Marley? Was there a particular
song? Hit some Bob Marley. I think that's a good one. Yeah, because it is important to note that, that, And that's why BFM in particular and student radio in general was important, because it was playing new music that people were interested in and listening to and buying when no other radio stations were.
Was there anything in particular from Bob that you would like to hear?
Something early 70s.
Okay, you've put me on the spot. It's a mateys, Bob Marley.
If you were able to find something...
I'll play Natural Mystic then. Natural Mystic.
Because okay. I also had a toilet ad. You were talking about the type of programming that would be on Radio B back then. And they did have some PSAs that I've got from Graham Hill.
On
a USB stick. This one here, if we can engage Burley for a sec, here we go. This is one to help students to locate toilets around the campus.
Take a load off your mind and learn where the toilets are around the campus. We have a wide range of architectural styles reflecting the range of university buildings. There's the urban sprawl of urinal wall available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week below the Student Association offices. Or for the more intimately inclined, each faculty provides facilities for release for its own persons. The German department claims to have the last remaining outhouse on campus, and the key is freely available at 23 Wynyard Street. And now a word for the women. The best coverage on the tissue scene is provided by the library building toilets, which are found in the basement on the opposite side of B28. Please remember, do not be shy to ask the appropriate authorities if in trouble as to where and how to use the toilet facilities, as they will be most obliging. For those tired and sweaty bodies, the Student Association has provided showers, once again underneath its main offices. In efforts to conserve energy, mixed showering is one avenue the association is looking closely into. It will be best if one obtains a towel from the gym at only 12 cents before showering in order to prevent embarrassment to both the observer and the observed.
There we go. 12 cent showers. Can you believe that? 12 cent showers? They were also offering parking spaces, I believe, at 50 cents.
It's hard to beat.
It's almost crazier than the $50,000.
Hey, now, Russell Brown, thank you so much. People go and check out Audio Culture. Let's go out on this Natural Mystic by Bob Marley. Hey, Russell, lovely. Thank you so much. We'll hear
from you
soon.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, mate. Okay. Bye.
Natural mystic flow.
That was
Audio Culture on 95BFM.
Thanks to Audio Culture, Iwi Waiata, the Noisy Library of New Zealand Music. Go to audioculture.co.nz. It's just